So I'm going to start today by reading a koan, which we actually aren't going to spend much time commenting on. I just wanted to set the stage for a story I'm going to tell you. So this is the 48th koan in the Mumon Khan, which is the last koan. And Mumon always said that he didn't set up the Mumon Khan in any particular order, just sort of accident, which no one really believes. The first koan is Mu, as you all know. And this final koan kind of sets forth a profound fact of our practice. So I'm going to read it to you. And the title of the koan is Kempo's One Way. And the case goes like this, and maybe we'll just read the case. A monk once asked Kempo, the Bhagavats, meaning the wise men, the Bhagavats of the 10 directions have one road to nirvana. Where, may I ask, does that road begin? Kempo held up a stick, drew a line in the air, and said, here. Later, the monk asked Uman's help, famous Zen master Uman. Uman held up his fan and said, this fan has jumped up to the 33rd heaven and hit the nose of the deity there. The dragon carp of the eastern sea makes one leap and it rains cats and dogs. That's the koan. So without going too much into this, let's just point out these two things, this one road to nirvana. One master said the road was this, just drew a line in the air. The other master said it was my fan jumping up to heaven, hitting a carp, and flipped its tail and rained cats and dogs, and all this happened, et cetera, et cetera. So just that's just to set the stage for something that I remember from many, many years ago. Two or three times, perhaps, I went to some longer sesshin in a famous Zen center. This is an old Zen center, one of the first ones in the United States, actually, in New York City, in Manhattan. It was on the east side, as I recall. And it was being rented by or utilized by the Zen master I was studying with at the time, Sasaki Roshi, who was a Japanese Rinzai master. I had actually spent about a year in a monastery that he ran outside of L.A. called Mount Baldy Zen Center. And this was after I'd left the Zen Center. A few years later, I continued to study under Roshi whenever I was able to meet up with him. And this was a time he was coming out to New York City. So I did this whole seven-day session in New York City. And I believe I went with Stan and my brothers, I think they were there too. We were all practicing together back then. And we did this session. So I don't believe I went outdoors at all during the session. I think I spent the whole time inside to avoid distraction because you're in the middle of Manhattan there. So we spilled out into the street after the session was over. And those of you who have done a sesshin, or perhaps just a zazenkai, or any kind of intense period of sitting, you know how sensitive your senses get. So I stepped down on the street, and it was an instantaneous immersion in a world of Maya, I guess you could call it. I remember seeing taxi cabs driving down the street, and they had these, the lit signs on the roof with advertising. And then I remember seeing other ads, billboards, and whatever it might have been. I realized that when we step out onto the street, we're immersed in a sea of propaganda, I guess you could call it. Very intense propaganda. It's just pictures of beautiful people with white teeth and sexy things and attractive, glittering watches and everything like that. And after being in a very quiet, internal, deep space for 7 days, it just popped. We walked down the street and we got into a bad neighborhood pretty quickly. There was a strip club. We decided to check that out. And one thing led to another. And then I think we were walking to a street corner later at night. You know, we just basically, we went from the master saying the road, the single road to nirvana is here, drawing a line, to Uman saying the fan flipped up to the 77th heaven and hit the carp in the nose and it rained cats and dogs. It was like from one to the other. And yes, both are the one road to nirvana. So I remember we got to a street corner and I saw these guys with boxes set up. They had these cardboard boxes and they were playing this game called Three Card Monty. So the way the game is played is you've got two black cards like spades and you've got a red card like a heart. And they would show you the cards and then they would just sort of flip them around and you'd try with your eye to follow the red card, because if you were to pick the card that was red, you'd win. You'd make a bet, like a $20 bet. And I saw some people playing, and I saw people winning, and then I actually noticed that at one point, the person running this game, the three-card Monty guy, had actually accidentally, with air quotes, bent the red card, bent the heart card. So now the card had a bend in it, and he was flipping it around in a way that you could follow the card, and you could also see the bend. And it was absolutely certain which one was the red card. So one of us, I can't remember if it was me or someone else, we threw down a $20 bill. Other people were winning. A couple of people lost. But it was obvious when they lost that they just didn't see what you saw. You knew where the red card was. So we flipped it down, and then he did his thing, and then we flipped it down. Because they wait until the cards are done. Then they ask you to bet. Put the $20 bill down. Takes the bent card, which I have now seen multiple times, flips it over to spade. Lost. That was really mind-blowing. Sleight of hand, who knows what. And now let's zoom forward. I remembered this because of something that actually happened on a trip I was just on. Most of you know that I recently got back from a trip to Eastern Europe. And the last city of the three that we visited was Budapest, which is just a wonderful city. I recommend you all go there someday. Budapest is split in half by the Danube River. On one half is the grand old, sort of expansive, flat area with the most ornate buildings, and a parliament on the Danube, and just absolutely old world, war-scarred. It's the city of Pest, or the area of Pest, in this city of Budapest. Across the Danube, and you can walk across a bridge called the Chain Bridge, it's a very famous bridge, is the area called Buda. Not B-U-D-D-H-A, but B-U-D-A. But they indeed have some plays on words. They have a Buddha bar, and other types of Buddhist puns. So anyway, we walked across one day to Buda. And Buda is not flat, it's built on hills. And actually, to even get up into the area where there are these very, very old castles and palaces and a big monument way out on a point, you have to climb a very steep hill. So you get up the steep hill, and now you're looking down over the Danube, and you see the area of Pest just expanding outward almost as far as the eye can see, this ancient city of Pest. And we got way, way out to a point because we had seen a big monument there. It's a big, tall war monument. When we got up there, you saw it was this young woman holding some kind of feather, maybe a dove feather or something, holding it up to the sky. And on this sort of rocky point, you look down over the Danube River. So we got up there and toured around a bit, and then there were some stairs going down from this big monument to a flattened terrace, and there were three guys there. One of them had a box, cardboard box, set up on end, and he was moving some things on this box from a distance, and I saw the other two guys, and they all had money in their hands. So when I got close, I saw what was going on. This was something called, not three-card Monte, but the shell game. You must have heard of this. You have a single pea or something, a marble, and you've got three shells. And you see the player, the whatever he is, the con artist, put the shell on top of the marble, and then he shuffles around these shells, and then you have to pick which shell has the marble under it. And then if you're right, you win, and if you're wrong, you lose. He had two guys that were playing this game. Now, they all looked Hungarian to me. And they were all older, and they all had a lot of money in their hands. And I was watching this game for a while, watching him shuffle around these shells, and then the guy who was playing him would make a bet. It would be a big bet, usually. Like, if this was in euros, the local currency is forints, so that was a little bit of a tip-off. They're playing in euros. They're probably not looking for locals. They're looking for foreigners who don't know better that this is a con game to put their euros down. So this was a 100-euro bet. That's a lot of money. That's like $120. So I watched this guy with the shells, and then the guy betting, you know, sometimes would win and sometimes would lose. Sometimes the guy moving the shells would actually give him his winnings first and then do the game. Like, here, take the 100 first and then we'll do it. And then he might pick wrong, and then he'd have to give not only the 100 back but another 100. And then the other guy got involved too. So I saw this game going on. Then I watched him as he was like moving the shells. He was very deft at accidentally, put it in air quotes again, tipping up one of the shells. So you could see there was a little red marble underneath it, a little red pea. And then he'd keep going, and then when the person made a bet, whether they were right or wrong, you knew exactly which shell the marble's in. It was always under that shell. This went on for 5-10 minutes. I was very fascinated by it. There was an American near me who was really blown, like, couldn't believe, oh my God, this is so easy. I turned and said, look, don't do it. Don't do it. This is a con game. He said, what do you mean? Look, he's showing you where the marble is. I said, don't do it. So sure enough, eventually, he couldn't resist. Pulled a 100-euro bill out of his wallet, had it there in his hand. Guy did the shells. Even tipped up a little bit, you know, you could kind of see it, it's moving fast, really fast. And then this American guy pointed to the shell that I would have pointed at that obviously had the marble under it. The guy picked it up and it's empty. Picked up another one and there's the marble. And I saw this guy go, oh my God, he lost his 100 euro. How did he do that? How did he do that? This is a classic con game. There's actually a name for it in German. I forget the name. It's something rig, R-I-G, something rig. It's not a game of skill. This is the important issue, is that it's not simply that this person moves the shells very quickly, and if your eye is fast enough and you don't get tricked by some sleight of hand, you'll know where that marble is. This is a con. You will always lose. Unless he lets you in to draw you in a little further, you will always lose. I pondered this for a while. I said, what's going on here? How does he do it? I remembered that these so-called shells look kind of like bottle caps, but each of them had a little round disc on the top of them. And then I said, wait a minute. Those things must be magnetic. And when he puts the shell down, there's something inside this little red marble that's magnetized, and it gets pulled up. And when he wants it to be under a certain shell, he taps the top of the shell, and it releases the magnet somehow. And there appears the little marble. So this is a classic con game. So why am I bringing this up? What is this saying about this? Well, first of all, this is something, it's a kind of con. I don't know if you ever saw this movie called The Grifters. It was It's a wonderful movie. I think it was in the late 70s or early 80s. I don't remember exactly when I saw this film, but it was just a fabulous, what they call cinema noir. It dealt with something dark and dangerous and creepy. It had to do with these three or four people, these grifters. I think one of them was John Cusack. Another was Angelica Houston, just a fabulous role she played. And Annette Bening, and I think there was also, what was his name, Warren Beatty, I think he was in it. They played these grifters. What is a grifter? A grifter is a con artist. Now, they were all expert at something called the short con. Short con. You had to be expert at that. What is the short con? It's like this shell game or three-card Monty. You have to quickly trap the victim. You trap them in two ways. One way is through greed, their conviction that they're going to make some money here. And the other is through pride, that they're smarter than you. You're the con man, but they're smarter than you. You didn't notice that you had accidentally tipped up the shell. You didn't notice that you had accidentally bent the heart. Right? So you're conning them. They don't realize they're being conned. They think they're conning you. This is called a short con. It doesn't take very long to set up. It takes a couple of minutes. Usually you need some helpers. So when I was there in Budapest out in that little point, he had two people that are called shills. Shills. They were betting and some were winning and some were losing. But you felt smarter than them. They're stupid. Oh, how did he not know that? Obviously the marble was under that shell. How did he not notice that? You see how they get you? They get you through greed and they get you through pride. And then when they tricked you and you're fooled, you feel humiliated. So this is the short con. And in this movie, they showed these grifters pulling various short cons on all sorts of people. It might have been three-card Monty, it might have been something else. These little con games. Then there was something called the long con. And the long con was a much more long-term, difficult, painstaking process, but one that paid off much, much more. You wouldn't win just $20 or 100 euros. You'd win big time, big time. What this long con took was trust. You had to, not just the greed and the pride, because that had to be there too. The victim had to really think they were going to make a ton of money. And they had to feel like they were in the in crowd. They were someone different than the average person. You were letting them in on something. But it took months, sometimes years, to slowly develop this con, suck this person in or these people in, and then trigger the con and get their money. So these grifters actually, part of the movie, without spoiling it, because I think you all should see it, they long conned each other. These were con artists conning each other. Conning each other. Isn't that interesting? The short con and the long con. So why would I bring this up? Why would I bring this up? We are doing a practice, an aspect of which is to uncon ourselves, uncon, to become unconned. Now there's a short con and there's a long con. What is the short con? Let's start there, the short con. The short con happens when your mind attributes meaning to something that it doesn't have, and you're conned. Happens quickly. Happens with words. Things suddenly get named. Then they're given various levels of importance. They relate to you in a certain way. You like them or don't like them. All these things happen almost instantaneously. Now, there is a long period of setup, but this is an instantaneous thing. It's a con. We get conned by our daydreams, by our what is called discursive thinking, the ever-changing flow of thinking that pulls the mind out of its, what the master drew as a single line, pulls us out. We can't get there. Can't get there. So this is the short con. What's the long con? The long con is something much deeper, not so conscious, although often it is, often what we would call subconscious or unconscious. It's the belief in an entity with characteristics standing apart from the world on one side of a dividing line. It's on one side of the line and the entire world is on the other side of the line. And we buy into it totally. And it's supported by society. It's emphasized by all the people we know. Strengthened. It's the story of my life. It took many, many years to develop it, to develop trust in it, to believe in it. And yet Zen says this is a con. We're being conned into believing that what we are is a separated entity called me with characteristics including a history, a set of beliefs, a story, habits, a body, and that all of these things somehow are, if changing very slowly, but there's something persistent and continuous about it that makes a me separated from everything else on one side of a dividing line. This is the long con. How do we deal with this? How do we do it? How do we uncon ourselves? Now, one approach to the long con, which is the more insidious of the two cons, the short con is something that we learn to undermine through the very mechanism of Zazen. So the mechanism of Zazen is to learn to be mindful, to focus, to develop Jodaki, to put your mind's eye in the pit of your stomach, to hold on to one thought. All the ways in which we learn how to sit. This is a critical skill to learn to deal with the short con, which is what tends to trip us up moment by moment. But the long con is a whole different story. So the long con. What I'm going to do now is read the koan we're going to take up today, and then we'll go a little deeper into this. So this koan is actually a unique one, and it is not in any of the collections. It is utilized by some Zen centers as one of what is called the miscellaneous koans. So this particular center has, I want to see here how many, with several, probably about 30 or 40 koan here that are assigned to a student after they have broken through. So after they have broken through with an initial koan. Now, get it that you may be able to break through with Mu or Hu or have a spontaneous enlightenment doing Shikantaza, but you are not done with the work. You've just started. You've just started. This koan, the long con in particular, is very deep, very persistent. You may see through it in one way, but not in another, and get caught again. This can go on for a long time. So these koan are partly to teach us how to work with subsequent koan that are more colorful and multidimensional than Mu or Hu, but also that are pointing out how to undermine this con, this con. So I'm going to read this koan. So it goes like this. This is the first part of it. We may not have time for the second part, but if we do, I'll go into that a bit. So it goes like this. In the sea of eyes, that's I-S-E, sea of eyes, 10,000 feet down lies a single stone. I wish to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. I'll read that again. In the sea of eyes, 10,000 feet down lies a single stone. I wish to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. I looked up today, before coming in here, this sea of eyes, I-S-E-F. Is this really, is this like a play on words? You know, because eyes meaning like something that sees, the sea of eyes, or something very intimate, this eye. And I do think this is, to some degree, a play on words, but it's also a place. In Japan, it's called the Bay of Eyes. I don't know if there's a Sea of Eyes. The Bay of I-S-E. So in the sea of eyes, in the sea of eyes, in this intimate space, which is vast and has no edges, 10,000 feet down, 10,000 feet down. Have you ever gone 10,000 feet down? What's that like? Now, if you've ever dived, you learn various techniques to get down. And I've talked about this before, but just to go into it a little bit. It's very important in diving to be able to control what's called your buoyancy. Your buoyancy. To be able to go up when you want to go up, go down when you want to go down, and to stay floating at a single level when you want to stay at that single level. It's very, very important, not just to enjoy the dive, but to stay safe and not hurt yourself. So the first step is you wear something called a BCD, a buoyancy compensation device. It's a vest you wear. It has an air bladder in it, and it has pockets for weights. So it's connected to your tank. You're able to fill it with air when you first jump off the boat so that you can float on the water and then go down in a very controlled way. You go down by letting out the air. You have weight that naturally through gravity brings you down. You have to gradually let this air out. Let this air out. Get down deep. As you get down, the further down you go, I've gone down maybe to 120 or 130 feet, which is not very deep. There are very, very deep divers that have gone down below 300 feet. They're crazy, and some of them get hurt and die. Further down you go, the more colors get washed out and the darker things are, the quieter it is, the less you see, the more you feel surrounded by a kind of vastness. And it's very intimate because there's no communication with anyone else. You can't talk. So you go into a very intimate place, way down deep. I remember one time diving in Little Cayman Island, and there's a famous wall there. It's called the Bloody Bay Wall. And these wall dives are actually underwater cliffs. So the boat lets you off near the cliff, you swim out about 20 or 30 yards, and then you look over the edge and you see nothing but this ledge going down into blackness. And you go over the edge and you let the air slowly out of your BCD and gradually descend while you clear your ears, very slowly. As you go down deeper and deeper, 100 feet, 110 feet, it's a funny, strange thing that happens. You can develop something called nitrogen narcosis, which is a very elated sensation, very elated. It's almost like having a martini. It's nitrogen building up in your bloodstream. So here you are at this depth. Bloody Bay Wall is so deep, it's actually more than 5,000 feet deep. So that's like a mile down. All you see is blackness. There's nothing below you. It's just blackness. You see a little bit of wall coming down, and below is just blackness. Above, it's so far above, you barely see the top of the surface in the sky because so little light filters down here. It's dark, and you're high. It's really neat. It's kind of a paradigm for this. In the sea of eyes, 10,000 feet down, how do we get down there? How do we deal with this, what you would call short con, the air in your BCD, the random thoughts, the momentary concerns, the thing you're going to do next, the thing that someone said to you the day before, the situation in your life, okay, something that is getting you, or just your thoughts running their tape loops, random thoughts, stupid thoughts, dreamlike thoughts. This is the air in your BCD, in this paradigm. I want to go to 10,000 feet down. I want to go all the way to the bottom, because in the sea of eyes, 10,000 feet down, lies a single stone. I want to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. So we learn this technique. We learn to focus on one thing. This is that weight in our BCD. We learn to let out the air. What's the technique for letting out the air? Letting go of the thoughts. Remember, I've said this many times. Don't battle with thoughts. They're not your enemy. They serve purpose in certain situations, particularly when you want to float at the surface. But you don't want to be there right now. You want to go down to the bottom of the sea of eyes. You want to go 10,000 feet down. How do you do it? Drop off the meaning. Thoughts are like anything else. Thoughts are like smells, sounds, taste, touch, sights. They are sensations sensed by the sense organ of the brain. And if we are able simply to let go of, drop off, forget, benignly neglect the meaning of the thoughts without stopping the thoughts, without doing battle with the thoughts, then we begin to realize that thoughts are like everything else. They're like this whole fabric of experience and sensation. They're just another sensation. Now I can use them rather than be pulled around by them. I can use them as part of this one fabric of sensation, which I am now observing very closely. Or, observing closely in Shikantaza, or in any other particular practice, for example, breath. Let's use breath as an example. I see that the thoughts, the sensations in my body, the smell of the incense, the sight of the wall, perhaps, dimly seen through my eyes, are all there. They're all there. They're all connected. But they're of no particular meaning. I've dropped the meaning off. I've dropped off the names. I'm letting go of the short con. I'm letting go of it. Not doing battle with it. Not trying to figure it out. Not trying to win any particular game. I'm letting go of it. I'm just watching it. And now I may just narrow my focus down to one little piece of this whole big thing. This whole big one connected thing. One piece might be the sensation of my breath moment by moment, or the thought sound mu. Or if I'm doing Shikantaza, I may just allow it all to be exactly as it is. Just make it really big and broad and giant, but not step out of it. This is this line the master drew. The one single road to nirvana. It's this sinking down, not being stopped by the meaning of your thoughts, by naming things, by giving them value and importance. You're entering a different space. Now, as we go down, there's also gravity pulling us down. We have weights in our pockets. What is this gravity? It's this deep heart, this deep wanting, this yearning, to go to the center, to go to the bottom, to get down to where the single stone lies. If we don't have this really strongly, we can only go to a certain depth, and then the air in our BC starts to pull us back up. We've got to keep letting the air out, but also be drawn down. We have to be drawn down to this level. This is why, in this particular koan, they say, in the sea of eyes, in this vast fabric of sensation, this one fabric of sensation, 10,000 feet down, 10,000 feet. This is that impulse we have as Zen students to go all the way down to the deepest part of ourselves. Lies a single stone, single stone. I wish to pick up that stone without wetting my hands. What is this? A strange comment. Without wetting my hands. There's another koan or a saying in Zen, if you bring me that melon without using your feet, I'll take it from you without using my hands. If you bring me that melon without using your feet, I'll take it from you without using my hands. How do you take something from someone without using your hands? What total involvement need there be to not have someone standing apart using something? Using. This is the long con. The sense that I'm pulling the strings of my body. There's someone in here, there's some entity, it stands apart. It uses the world, it uses others, it uses circumstances. Always looking for a gain. Always thinking it's smarter than everyone else. Or dumber, depending on my particular mood that day. It's the story of my life. It creates the sense of an entity passing through time that's fixed. Someone standing on the side of a flowing river, looking at the river flowing past. The river being everything else, my whole life. But I want to go down below the short con, 10,000 feet down, and pick up this single stone. Single, singular, one thing. One thing. Undivided. It's a stone, single stone. We get down to this level often in our practice. We get down to a very, very deep place, and all the superficial thoughts seem to evaporate at that point. We're very focused. It can be a very wonderful, joyful feeling. Remember that nitrogen narcosis you feel down around 100 feet and deeper. It can be a joy to it. They call it shamatha or dhyana. Dhyana. It's a very light feeling, a joyful feeling, a feeling of wondrous delight. But there's still some dividing line, still something, some subtle, thin, sheer veil line between me and the object of my meditation. I may bring mu down to such a deep level as only mu, but there's still some thin veil. How do I pick up this single stone without wetting my hands? Without wetting my hands. How do I do it? This is part of the process. We push ourselves against this barrier. We slam ourselves sometimes, throw ourselves against it. We just yearn. We wonder. We get to this place where it seems almost there, almost. How do I cross that threshold? Remember that koan I first read? The single road to nirvana is just this line. Drawing it from up to down, 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 down. And then Uman said, well, my fan flips up to the 77th heaven, hits the carp there in the nose, and it flips his tail and rains cats and dogs. Suddenly, jumping into your experience as it is, without any dividing line. Any dividing line. No one can tell you how to do that. You have to suddenly take this leap. How can you take this leap? How can it be taken? The only way it can be taken is if it has already been done. Not something to create, not something to achieve, not something to understand. Remember the Zen master said, there's nothing in particular to realize. Nothing in particular to realize. Just let go of the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. Let go of the idea that you're not already Buddha. This is a leap. So there's a another part of this koan. Maybe I'll read it here. So it goes like this. Here is the stone. I've gone down there. Here is the stone. This is kind of like test questions to see if the student's really gotten this. Here is a stone inscribed with three lines. The top line is a signature. The right line reads, cannot get wet. The left line reads, cannot get dry. These are wonderful, enticing questions, aren't they? Three lines on this stone, the first one a signature. The second line reads, cannot get wet. Remember, he said, I want to pick up this stone without wetting my hands. Cannot get wet. And the left-hand line says, cannot get dry. Does this maybe have something to do with that first master drawing the line, cannot get wet? This essence of what I am can't be burned, can't be harmed, can't be damaged, can't be born, can't die, can't get wet. The second line is Uman with the fan. The stone on the left-hand line says, cannot get dry, cannot be other than just this right now, in each moment, just. In our deep zazen, in the sea of eyes, 10,000 feet down, when we're here confronting this single stone, we can't get wet. The bell rings, we make a bow, we stand up, we do our shikan, kinhin, and step by step, sensation, sound, smell, can't get dry. No dryness, no entity, just this. So this is the two sides of our practice, the two sides. I'll just read one more thing here, and then we will end our teisho. This is the commentary on that Kenpo's One Way. So the commentary goes like this. One goes to the bottom of the deep sea and raises a cloud of sand and dust. The other goes to the top of a towering mountain and raises foaming waves that touch the sky. The one holds, the other lets go. And each, using only one hand, sustains the teaching of Zen. What they do is exactly like two children who come running from opposite directions and crash into each other. In this world, such people who grasp truth directly are difficult to find. But if we look at these two great teachers with the true eye of the absolute point of view, neither of them really knows where the road to nirvana is. So I'll leave you in this state of puzzlement and we'll end here now.